Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, we're taking on the future of the past. Alexander Stiller warns that humanity is in the midst of a fundamental rupture with its own history. But first, we begin with new troop movements in Israel. The Israelis have sent troops toward the Gaza Strip in retaliation for the latest Palestinian suicide bombing, which killed 15 Israelis. Earlier, I spoke with Lee Hockstatter, Jerusalem bureau chief for The Washington Post, and asked him about the latest moves.
Tanks are massing around Gaza, Israeli tanks, and interestingly as well, reservists, some thousands of reservists, Israeli reservists, have been issued emergency immediate call-up notices. Not quite clear on the numbers, probably not as many as the 20,000 who were called up last month at the beginning of Operation Defensive Shield, which were the Israeli attacks in the West Bank, but certainly a significant number have been called up this time as well, which suggests a significant operation to attack Gaza. Attacking Gaza, however, is in some ways trickier than attacking the West Bank cities. Gaza, as you may know, is 1 million people who are in what amounts to an internment camp. It's a fenced-off, surrounded area wedged between 147 square miles, wedged between Israel, Egypt, and the Mediterranean Sea.
So what issues does that pose, Lee Hockstatter, that were not there in the West Bank in Operation Shield?
Well, for one thing, about two-thirds of the people in Gaza, something like 600 or 700,000 people, live in refugee camps. These are enormous, sprawling, packed refugee camps. Some of the most populated places in the entire planet are in Gaza City.
Is this like Jenin? Jenin had refugee camps as well.
Well, there are refugee camps all over the place, but Jenin's refugee camp was something like 13,000 people. In Gaza, they have refugee camps that are like 100,000 people. These are huge places. And in these refugee camps in Gaza, in addition to the fact that they're enormous, much, much bigger than the ones in the West Bank, the population of children is just massive. I mean, when you wander around Jabalia refugee camp, for example, which is 100,000 people, very near Gaza City, I'd say two-thirds of the population is under the age of 15. They're just kids everywhere. And the idea of attacking a place like Jabalia, which is a hotbed of militancy and which is a breeding ground for Hamas, the militant group Hamas, you're attacking a place that's absolutely thronged with small children.
Are there signs then or comments to indicate that Israel is looking at a different type of action in Gaza?
There are some Israeli officials who say they're going to be very targeted, being very cautious, but in a place as tightly packed as Gaza, this is impossible. It'll be extremely difficult, I think impossible, for Israel to avoid large-scale civilian casualties.
Does Israel seem concerned about repeating the kind of action that we saw in Jenin?
Well, of course, Israel insists that what it did in Jenin was A, justified, and B, extremely cautiously carried out. Of the 50 or 60 or 70 people who were killed there, the vast majority, according to Israel, were gunmen. Human rights groups have a slightly different take on it. They think almost half were not armed. But in any event, Israel feels no regrets whatsoever about what happened in Jenin. But as I say, attacking Gaza is really much more difficult, and I think it's a real military challenge.
Yet massed tanks sounds very much like the earlier operation.
Yeah, and it's important to keep in mind that in this particular conflict, there's really very little that's new under the sun. I mean, Israel did attack refugee camp Jabalia, the big one, in Gaza at the beginning of March or the end of February. So almost everything that we've seen here has happened in some way or another, usually in a slightly smaller scale in the past. As the conflict goes on, Israel ups the ante, as do the Palestinians, and the scale of it expands. But there have been attacks on Gaza in the past, most recently about 2 months ago.
So at this point, Israel appears to believe it can go in and effectively remove some of the threats that it believes have been behind suicide bombing, including the most recent one this week.
You could look at it a couple of ways. They could believe that they can effectively remove a threat, or they could just believe that this is punishment, deterrence, and that the way to deter further terror is not to remove the terrorist infrastructure, because after all, almost nobody here really believes that that can be done. When you talk to Israeli generals, they don't believe it can be done particularly. What they think you can do is punish the Palestinians, deal them a blow, bloody their nose, and in that way deter future attacks. The idea of removing the terrorist infrastructure, I think even the Israeli generals would tell you, is more of a slogan or a cliche than anything really meaningful on the ground.
Then, in fact, it's something more like attempting to cow Palestinians into at least stopping suicide bombings, if not submission.
You know, each side is in the business of believing that the other side understands only force. Each side is convinced that only by hitting the other side and hitting it very hard, bloodying its nose, will the other side come to its senses. And so this is the dynamic that's at work here. It's also interesting to point out that the suicide bomber the other night who hit the pool hall in Rishon LeZion, the city in southern Israel.
15 dead
south of Tel Aviv, rather. That suicide bomber has not been identified. Extremely unusual. We're not really sure that he's from Gaza. A couple of Israeli officials have said that they think he may have been from Gaza, but we don't really know that. And if he was from Gaza, it would be extremely unusual. As I mentioned at the outset, Gaza is like a big internment camp. It's surrounded by electronic fences. You can't get out of Gaza. Very, very difficult. And as far as I'm aware, there has not been one suicide bomber who's come out of Gaza into Israel in the course of this conflict in the last 19 months. If this fellow the other night was from Gaza, I believe that would be the first instance of a suicide bomber actually managing to escape or somehow tunnel out of Gaza and hit Israel proper.
If this bomber was not from Gaza, then the point of bloodying the Palestinians' nose in Gaza would be, does it somehow cycle back through? Do the Israelis think that then political pressure from Palestinians in Gaza would be exerted on extremists elsewhere to put the brakes on suicide bombing?
Different Israelis see this different ways. But I think that the lowest common denominator, and probably the most universally held view of this, is that, as I said before, many Israelis think that the only way to bring the Palestinians to their senses and to get them to stop this intifada, to get and to force Arafat to rein in his militants, is simply to cause great pain to the Palestinians. Gaza, as you're probably aware, was not hit in the large Israeli military offensive last month. Gaza was excluded. It's a third of the Palestinian population in the West Bank, and Gaza is in 1 million of the 3.3 million are in Gaza, and Gaza has not been hit in the last couple of months. And so I think if there's any logic to this or certain rationale to this, it's simply to cause pain in a place where pain has not been caused recently.
Lee Hockstetter is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. The past isn't dead, William Faulkner wrote. It isn't even past. Maybe not, but our guest tonight, Alexander Stilla, suggests that humanity may be in the midst of a complicated divorce with history. Year by year, we have more historical data and less connection to history. In his new book, The Future of the Past, Stilla says that technology can help preserve pieces of our history, but not the context in which it evolved. Data-filled CD-ROMs and DNA databases do not equal the real thing. They cannot replace the regional dialects and cultures being lost to globalization, or even our own sense of our own historical culture as it passes. Our relationship with the past is changing, says Stilla, maybe collapsing. Are we walking away from history? What history do you see the world at risk of losing? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Alexander Stilla. He writes for The New Yorker and The New York Times and is author of the new book, The Future of the Past. Good evening and welcome, Alexander Stilla.
Thanks very much for having me.
It's great to have you. It's been a long time since we've talked, and I've admired how your work has just grown and become wonderful over the years, Alexander. It's terrific.
Well, I'm glad to be reunited with you.
It's been a while. There's so much to talk about tonight. It's such a provocative thesis you've got in the book. We would love it if you would start us off to give a flavor both of your lovely writing and of the kind of thing that you're worried about the world losing. Could you just take it from the top in your introduction and read us a page and a half or so there?
Sure. In the city of Rome, the physical remains of the past are everywhere, a living palimpsest where the many layers of 2,700 years of history exist side by side in strange juxtaposition. As cars whiz by the ancient Republican temples and the Art Deco theater in the Largo Argentina, you wait for the bus near the spot where Julius Caesar was assassinated. A few blocks away, faces of long-dead Romans stare out from the facades of modern buildings decorated with old sarcophagi, and a block of 20th-century shops curves gently, conforming to the shape of the ancient amphitheater on whose foundations it stands. In the basement of a modern pizzeria, there is a large sundial that kept time when the Emperor Augustus ruled the world. I found these remnants of the past living so gracefully and casually in the midst of everyday life strangely comforting. They change your sense of time and your place in the world, making the ups and downs of the present seem smaller, while also making you feel a part of a much larger continuum. The city has seen every possible form of human glory, folly, and depravity, has witnessed emperors who declared themselves gods and holy men dressed in sackcloth who crawled up marble staircases on their bare knees. It has been ravaged and rebuilt numerous times and survived with something of its soul intact. Amidst the din of tourists, street vendors, quarreling neighbors, motorini gunning their engines, women putting out their laundry, children playing soccer in the square, the massive harmonious forms of the Pantheon and St. Peter's Basilica loom in the background. And as you bathe in the happy, noisy confusion of the present, the great pagan temple and the central church of Christianity remind you that the important things in life are few, diminishing the sting of the ephemeral worries that crowd our minds from day to day.
Alexander Stilla reading from the introduction of his new book, The Future of the Past. We're going to be joined tonight in talking about the book by Lewis Gordon, Director of Africana Studies at Brown University, who joins us tonight from the studios of WRNI in Providence. Hello, Lewis Gordon.
Oh, hello, Tom.
Alexander Stilla, you convey immediately there the sense of life in Rome as imbued with history, that even the most mundane aspects of life are surrounded by it. But your book reads like a warning that we're somehow slipping away from that. You concede that history has always been lopped off as humanity has forged ahead, but you're worried that it's happening more quickly now than before. Yet it's a complicated argument you make. What's your central premise, Alexander?
Well, the argument, as you say, gain has always and progress in history has always been accompanied by loss. One culture has replaced another, and history is made up of layers. But I argue that this process is accelerated in the last couple of centuries, and particularly in the last 50 years. To give you a couple of facts that maybe demonstrate this, mm-hmm. If you consider that it took people during the Roman Empire 20 days to get from one end of the empire to the other, crossing the Mediterranean Sea, it took about the same time for Columbus to cross the ocean. In 1492, and it still took that amount of time to get news from, let's say, Europe to the United States in the 1830s or 40s. It took 2 weeks to get news from New York to Chicago.
So almost 2,000 years without much change in the pace of information flow.
That's right. And then with the telegraph in 1841, it becomes virtually instantaneous. And then similarly, for example, if you look at technologies, like it took 38 years for radio to penetrate 50 million American households. It took TV 13 years, cable TV 10, the internet 5. So there are ways in which technological change is speeding up. If you think, for example, about the fact that up until the 1870s in this country, most people were farmers, and people told time by the sun and the moon and lived according to the seasons. Now, of course, just about 2% of the population are involved in farming.
But Alexander, why does speed, why does more information coming at us faster necessarily mean a loss or rupture with history?
Well, of course, it doesn't necessarily, and there are lots of ways in which we're better informed than previous eras, and I don't mean to make a kind of anti-technological argument. What sort of interested me was simply observing around me that there was a kind of relationship between the accelerating technological change and the loss of information in certain places. For example, the first chapter of this book, and I've done it in through a series of narratives, mm-hmm. Is set in Egypt, and there the paradox is that, for example, we have wonderful new technologies like radar images taken from satellites in space, which can penetrate the sands of the desert and tell you what the topography of mm-hmm. ancient Egypt looked like 30,000 years ago, but the monuments of ancient Egypt are being eroded very rapidly by the byproducts of technological change.
Just pollution. As dramatically as the technology. Lewis Gordon, I want to bring you in just for a minute here. Do you resonate with this premise, more technology, more information, less knowledge?
As I read the book, I kept thinking about two very profound thinkers. One of them was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and the other one was Elias Canetti. Rousseau, in a wonderful essay, Discourse on the Arts and Sciences, articulated what's called the dialectics of enlightenment. And by that, what he meant was, in answer to the question, the knowledge and all that benefit humankind? His answer was yes in part, but no in many others.
That's exactly the dilemma we're looking at. We'll look at more of that, Lewis Gordon, when we come back. We've got to take a short break. Sorry to interrupt you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Alexander Stilla about his new book, The Future of the Past, and the notion that we may be in the midst of a fundamental rupture with history. What do you think? Are you feeling closer to or more divorced from history these days when we have the History Channel and CDs full of data? Are you as close to history as your parents are or were? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lewis Gordon, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you. You just got us into Rousseau, but I think you had more to say.
Sure. I was thinking about a wonderful text by Elias Canetti called Crowds and Power, in which he articulated a fundamental anxiety in the present age. And that anxiety is this sense that the collective force of the past was something that we survived. And in the midst of that survival, there's an anxiety around the past that tends to take the form in a greater pressure on technological achievement. In many ways, for instance, you brought up the question of speed. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how speed can bring with it the illusion of power. And the ability to move quickly, to think quickly, to respond to things quickly, brings with it the sense in which we can conquer everything, we can deal with everything. But you know, one of the underlying realities of this is that sometimes what may look like a situation of progress could also be a situation of decay. Mm-hmm. One beautiful part of it, I must say to Stilla, this is a beautifully written book. And what I like a lot about the book is the extent to which it brings in very wonderful language, the complexity of how we have to deal as a society with the question of maturation around some of the social impediments we face today. Among them is a rather ironic twist, the extent to which, for instance, the historical seems to be in decline within the process of how we go about dealing with history. You could find, for instance, that a complaint, for instance, in fact, in some history departments, is that many historians are no longer historical. There's a dependence, for instance, on the category of the archive or the methodological resources that themselves too are part of this dependence on a technological response.
So all the data is at our fingertips. We don't have to have it in our bones.
Correct.
Alexander Stilla, you write about this ambivalence that Lewis Gordon describes. On the one hand, you say we are actively or passively floating away from history. On the other, you describe a kind of longing for history in New Age infatuation with Atlantis and Stonehenge and ancient Egypt, and even in the nostalgic historical emphasis of Disney theme parks, you write.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, in fact, precisely because people have the sense of rootlessness and loss, I think there's a great hunger for a past, even if it has to be an invented past, so that you see phenomena like the one that I write about in the Egypt chapter of the New Agers, who have created a kind of fantasy version of ancient Egypt based on the Atlantis myth. Mm-hmm. And similarly, for instance, the fights one sees in this country, let's say, between white supremacists and Native American tribes over the Kennewick man, who owns this this corpse that's found in the northwest of the United States. The fact that, for example, the genealogy sites on the internet are among the most visited in absolute, I think shows that there is a real need for roots, identity, a grounding in the historical past. But so many of the forces in the world we live in make that very difficult.
You write that there's a genuine risk of our becoming a society with little historical framework in which to set all the information we have access to. Why?
partly I think, oddly enough, because of the bombardment of information that we're all exposed to. So I think there's a kind of difference between information and knowledge, and I think that we're a very present-oriented society, future-oriented society, and there are lots of good things about that. I think also television has had a greatly sort of a corrosive effect on on written culture, and television exists in a kind of world of the eternal present. And I'm sure Professor Gordon would probably confirm this. Friends who teach in the universities will tell you that you know, you can meet well-educated, well-prepared college students who don't know who fought in World War II. That's not very long ago. And I think that there is a widespread sense. For example, fewer people in this country can tell you who their congressman is today than 50 years ago, mm-hmm. when high school education and college education was much less accessible.
And of course, we know that lamentation. But you're going to something that's more subtle. You talk about the limits of historical preservation, about how we're in some circumstances moving to virtual reality versions of real antiquities, in others corralling everything that's old in museums. You even make the case that parks, that nature preserves, are in a sense now have been made into historical museums themselves, or just very large artifacts that nature itself we've relegated to history.
Well, in fact, I try to extend this preoccupation with this future of the past phenomenon, the paradox of technological change. I think it's present in nature because there, again, we also have extraordinary advancements in fields like genetics, in which we're now reconstructing family trees of species, and we can now tell more or less when the chimpanzee broke off from the bonobo and formed separate species. But these species in the world we actually live in are under enormous pressure because of the development of human beings. And so we're actually losing information, losing species in the world we actually walk around in.
So the irony is that the boat that brings the anthropologist to the Pacific Island next brings the fruit company and next brings the TV satellite dish and off you
precisely.
Go.
Precisely. So the same thing is happening in the world of societies and I would say that there is genuine progress with this. That, for example, 20 or 30 years ago, you very commonly saw remote, isolated societies dismissed as being savage or primitive. Now are studied with great respect and attention, and their cultures carefully documented, their language written down, grammars written. But the languages themselves are disappearing at a rapid rate, and with those languages, enormous cultural knowledge is being lost. So I think without demonizing progress and change, I simply wanted to document this period of this sort of weird twilight period that mm-hmm. we're living through, in which a lot is happening very quickly and of which most people are not aware.
And yet you are very candid about your own shifts in perception as you went around the world gathering the evidence of this. You say, the story shifted beneath me. I discovered how much more complex the issues were than I had originally supposed. And you go on to say that sometimes preservation, maybe in the case of a Madagascar rainforest in particular, is not necessarily the best thing, even if it keeps a token, an artifact of history around.
Well, there, for example, I set off to look at what I hoped would be a kind of model of third world conservation, an attempt to create a national park around the habitat of a lemur, these species of very early primates which exist only in Madagascar. This particular project was sort of widely touted as being an example of sensitive third world conservation, mm-hmm. which the U.S. government put up the money, the national government helped to set up the park, they ran and organized it, they worked with local people so that they wouldn't be hurt by the creation of this park. But as I began to do the research and then did the research on the ground, I learned that it was a lot more complicated than that, that in fact the local people felt dispossessed by this park. This was for them the umpteenth attempt of outside people to take away their land and to keep them from very necessary valued resources. These Madagascar is an unbelievably poor place, one of the poorest in the world. Mm-hmm. And so the creating a national park in a place when people are living one bad harvest away from starvation is a very morally problematic thing.
But
not to say that even creating the national park is a bad idea, but just to see how the interaction between nature, culture, human beings, mm-hmm. and the environment is a very, very complex business.
By that logic, as we head toward our 6th billion population, I guess now, is history doomed? If the needs of this very large population always come first, are we going to gobble up the rest of the evidence of history?
Well, of course, you know, we won't gobble up at all, and we'll you know, as happens in most times of history, you know, we'll lose a lot and we'll save a lot. I do worry about what we will lose. But I think, you know, unfortunately, for better or worse, choices are made generally by because of accident and in many cases because of power, who want something to be changed. I mean, what we have, for example, from the ancient world, we have because certain texts were copied down and recopied again and again. The things that weren't copied don't survive. So that, for example, you know, Sophocles wrote over 100 plays and we have only a handful of them. Mm-hmm. Many of the others may have been as great as the ones we have, but we'll never know. Sophocles was defeated at a couple of poetic contests in ancient Athens, and we have the names of the people who were considered better than him, but we don't have any of their plays. Mm. Similar kinds of things will happen. Not that I think we'll lose the Sophocles of our age, if there are any, but we'll lose a lot of other things. And tragically, I think, for example, when you're talking about less powerful cultures and civilizations around the world, there we may lose very, very fundamental central parts of those cultures that because they didn't have a particular voice in the process of what got kept and what got thrown out.
So we've always lost a lot as we moved, and yet we've moved. Chandra's on the line. Welcome, Chandra. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to supplement the different comments the guest is making. Mm-hmm. Just that along with the physical objects, I think we are kind of losing touch with the wisdom that has been accumulated over generations by different civilizations, and the current civilization is like driven by one theme, which is to make money, and we are kind of losing the wisdom that would give balance to the to life.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add this comment.
Well, let's put it to Alexander Stiller. And Chandra, thanks for your call. What about it, Alexander Stiller? I got the impression
I agree very much with that. In fact, I dedicated, we didn't have a chance to talk about it, but mm-hmm. I dedicated one of the chapters, in fact, to India and the attempts to clean the Ganges River. And what was particularly striking to me about that is that it wasn't just an attempt to preserve the river, but to preserve all of the religious traditions that have grown up around the Ganges over millennia. And there, for example, what is particularly interesting and moving about the people in India that I met was that they're very aware of wanting to preserve this ancient civilization and wisdom that's accumulated, as the listener said, over thousands of years, and yet they also want to, understandably, gain the material well-being of modern capitalist society. And how you get the one without losing the other is, I think, the thing that countries all around the world are struggling with. And there are many very sort of creative attempts to do this, as, for example, I tried to document in this India chapter, where I found particularly beautiful and moving when the main character of this chapter says about the people who have this relationship with the river, he says, please consider them an endangered species, these people who have a living relationship with the river, not just birds and plants, but those who still have this faith. If birds can be saved, if plants can be saved, let this species of people be saved by giving them water.
Lewis Gordon, it's no cut and dried issue here, what we're gaining and what we're losing.
Indeed. I would add to the caller's observation on the pursuit of wealth, the complex relationship of science to religion in the modern age. We're living also in a period with a form of science fundamentalism, and by this I mean not science in terms of how it can be understood in its creative sense, but science in the more hegemonic sense as being antipathetic to things religious or historical. Religion in its heart means to bind, and in many ways it's very difficult to maintain a properly religious view of the world without a connection to the past. It has themes of origins, mm-hmm. it has sacred objects, and so forth. But a particular ideological conception of science is antipathetic to that. And in many ways, that conception of science has linked itself to, again, a very problematic conception of technology in the interest in looking entirely in terms of a consequence in terms of what is sought rather than a connection to time immemorial.
Alexander Stiller, what about that? Help us understand how our relationship with history today may or may not be different from the relationships humans had with history in previous periods.
Well, I think one of the things, for example, in a society in which religion is, let's say, the primary value, the relationship is different in the sense that, for instance, in places in Asia, you wouldn't think of making a museum, let's say, of the objects, let's say, of the royal family of a country and so on, because these things belong to a living culture. For example, in Asia, temples are, rather than preserved, they're rebuilt because the religion that gave rise to those temples is still operating.
I've seen the temple in Japan that they rebuild every 20 years. It always smells like fresh pine, even though it's 1,000 years old.
That's right. And I think because there's a cultural continuity there, you can do that. You know, when we're dealing with, let's say, the monuments of ancient Greece or Rome, we leave them as a ruin because it would make no sense to rebuild a ruin from that time. One of the things that happens, for example, it's interesting that I try to document in the book is at a certain point, for example, in Rome, up until the 17th century, they used the Colosseum as a quarry for the travertine stone. And they would just, when they needed to build a church, they just lop off another wall. At a certain point in the 18th century, people became aware that these things had value and that the past was a finite quantity that could never be recovered, and they began to treat these things like holy objects. Mm. And that's an interesting passage in the history of European and American society, when suddenly the past becomes the past.
Well
in
that's
many, societies, the past isn't the past.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, part of what I wanted to ask is, you say we have so much data now, but not the same awareness. When the past was more intimate, or when it was more dependent on oral history for many people who didn't have schooling, do you think the sense of history was stronger, or with less data but more tradition, or weaker?
Well, you know, it's complex because I wouldn't vote for one thing or the other, or to say modernity is bad, because I'm a product of the modern civilization. I'm a product particularly of print culture, and I'm very attached to that. But, there is a sort of trade-off. For example, in societies where writing doesn't exist, on the one hand, tradition exists in people's heads because there's no other way to store it, and so every member of that society is almost honor-bound to absorb everything they need to know and live about their traditions and their society in their own head. But they are, of course, deprived of all the instruments that we have to record the past, and that to some degree means that their sense of history has a strong mythological element to it. So it's both, the past is very real for these people in the sense of the sense of the ancestors is a big part of that world. Mm-hmm. And writing gives us an ability to grasp the details of history that you can't in that way, and therefore I think is a wonderful thing. But there's always a trade-off, even in the passage from oral to written society.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking with Alexander Stilla about the future of the past. How much intimacy with history do we need to be healthy humans? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Alexander Stilla about his new book, The Future of the Past, and it's just the subject. He warns that we may be turning cultures, whole cultures, into disposable data. What do you think? If we lose our link to the past, what do we lose? Is technology zooming us away from history? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sarah's on the line. Welcome, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. By the way, I love your show. I can't tell you enough.
Oh, thank you so much.
Anyhow, but one thing I'm really surprised at is because we have so many different media channels that cater to all sorts of prejudices, and people with certain prejudices are adherent to only a certain media channel, which practically rewrites history. And before you know it, they pass that on to their children, and they pass on the forged history as if it was real history, and it goes on and on and on.
And maybe the very technology, the 400 channels, just gives us 400 versions. Sarah, let me put it to Alexander Stilla. Thanks for your call. Alexander, how about it? In this broad delta of media outlets, are we getting a diffused sense of history, maybe, as Sarah suggests, many inaccurate views of history, or just less history somehow?
Well, I think there is, one of the things that we're trying to work out as a society now is, for example, in technologies like the Internet or in cable TV, there's so many different outlets that you do have a kind of self-segregation phenomenon going on where the information world in a way reflects a kind of increased fragmentation of the society itself. And so you have Pentecostal groups with their own website and Third World pro-Palestinian groups with their website, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. You have interest groups that they communicate with themselves and not with others. And I think there is a kind of risk of fragmentation, loss of common culture in that. And so I think that the listener is onto something there, and there is a sort of a great capacity for the multiplication of bad information. The number of people who, around the world on the internet who believe that, the CIA or a Jewish conspiracy
brought down the towers
planes into the World Trade Center. Are innumerable, and that information multiplies, and then through something like the internet, it appears to have legitimacy because it's there in black and white on your computer screen. Or...
It's such an irony, and your book comes back to it again and again: the way that we have more information but less understanding of history. You say the loss of historical memory may be directly related to our thirst for knowledge and information. Why should that be?
Well, in some cases, it's very sort of material and physical. That, for example, when Napoleon invaded Egypt at the very end of the 18th century, there was both this process of discovery of an ancient civilization and the destruction of that. So they both his troops discovered the Rosetta Stone, which was the key to deciphering the hieroglyphics of ancient Egypt, and the society that had been mute for 2,000 years began to speak to us again. And yet they also raided every tomb and monument they could find and carted back to museums around the world what they found. So there was both a process of destruction and discovery, and they're both part of the modern thirst for knowledge. And so one of the people that I spoke to said, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle exists in this. To know it is to kill it, and that's,
or at least to change
a little,
is
a bit of an overstatement. But the point is, I think, valid that the process of our putting our hands on something does change it, and in many cases,
so
disturbs it.
Are you brave enough to suggest a way in which our data-devouring, information-obsessed era might also have a healthy relationship with history? How can we do it?
Well, I think there are fabulous positive potentials to a lot of the technologies that we have around us, from the internet to CD-ROMs. And I think that, because I do believe that that having a sense of history and a place in the world is important to people, I think people will begin figuring out ways to use this technology in a way that makes their lives richer and better, rather than simply getting caught up in, the pursuit of having the latest gadget.
Lewis Gordon, Alexander Stiller says that people have always had different kinds of relationships with history. History's always been destroyed. Is there something profoundly qualitatively different this time, or is this just one more turn of the wheel we're involved in?
I think what's profoundly qualitatively different this time is the global scope of it. Right now, the speed and means are available everywhere. And it puts into greater urgency the old adage. The adage is you can't really know where you're going if you do not know where you've come from. But a lot of where we've come from is disappearing. One thing that also strikes me is the distinction between past and history. There's much past, but history is something very unique. In many ways, history has with it a valuative element of things we would like to hand down through generations. What's particularly striking also about Stiller's discussion is also the way the impact of how history and power relate to each other. As we find many communities, cultures, the landscapes in which they live collapsing into places to be preserved, the question that goes through these people's minds is preserved for whom? In many ways, they are being politically structured as the custodians for us, but the us tend to be pretty much, as we opened up earlier, those who tend to be connected in a particular part of the world, although the impact of it is global.
So take care of that rainforest because we might want to visit
because
it sometime.
We want it. Yeah.
Alexander Stiller, we've just got a few seconds left, and I'm sorry for it, but how about it? Is there cause for optimism here, or do we just become accustomed to living more in the present with less history in our lives?
Well, I think that the real key is how lots of other societies around the world find creative responses to absorbing the impact of our presence and figure out sort of ways of synthesizing things into a new vocabulary and language. You see this, for example, in India in extraordinary ways where, you see people worshiping at shrines of Shiva with Hindi pop music and bright lights.
And it's all going on at once. Alexander Stiller, there's more than we're going to get to in this hour, and I'm sorry for it, but thank you for your new book.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alexander Stiller is author of The Future of the Past. In a moment, On Point's movie maven talks with one of Hollywood's hottest young directors. This is On Point. Christopher Nolan is getting a whirlwind tour of the movie business. Just a few years ago, he was walking the streets of London with a 16mm camera, making his first real film. Last year, he turned the movie world on its head and the film form upside down with the surprise hit Memento. Now, like so many independent filmmakers before him, he finds himself at the reins of a big Hollywood movie. On Point movie maven Garen Daly sat down with Christopher Nolan and talked with him about movies, money, and Memento.
You know, I'm amazed. In 1998, you made Following, which hit the Cecil circuit. And in 2000, you came out with this little art film called Memento. And now it's 2002, and you have a film that's produced by George Clooney, Steven Soderbergh, and it stars three Academy Award winners, Robin Williams, Hilary Swank, and Al Pacino. What's it been like for this very short trip you've gone so far?
Well, amazing, as you say. I mean, I have to pinch myself every now and again. But it's been great. I mean, it's been a pretty organic sort of progression. And what I've found from the three films at three different budget levels I've made is that the process is reassuringly familiar each time, because each time you're just trying to concentrate on what's the story you're trying to tell and how do you get it on screen.
What are you working on now?
I'm actually writing a film about the life of Howard Hughes that Jim Carrey is going to star in.
Wow.
He's a fascinating man, and it's kind of the great unmade Hollywood movie. People have been talking about it for decades, but I think we have an interesting approach to it.
Insomnia, why did you decide to take a Norwegian film and redo it?
I saw the original when it came out in 97, and I absolutely loved it, and I thought it was unimprovable and perfect in what it was trying to do. And I watched it literally twice through. You know, I had it on tape, and I just watched it again as soon as I finished it. But even while I was appreciating the completeness of the film, an idea suggested itself to me, which is that you could take the plot of the film, you could take the narrative events pretty closely, in fact, and really transform it and create something that had a rather different effect by changing the characters, most specifically the protagonist, by recasting the film in the mold of the great American cop dramas of the past, the kind of thing the studios used to be really good at making, and changing the protagonist into this kind of iconic cop figure, you know, from American movies, you could give the audience a rather different narrative experience. You could take them into the story in a different way and really leave them feeling very different about the various, you know, moral paradoxes that arise in the story.
As you know, Spider-Man just opened up and did $115 million in its opening weekend.
So I hear. Yeah.
Is there a place in Hollywood for someone who is making these small, smart, noirish films when the business seems to be drifting towards these large opening comic book films?
I think there's always a place for an alternative to whatever everybody else is doing. And I've found that in Hollywood, the industry there understands that, that there is a place for offering audiences something a little bit different. Because if everybody's making comic book movies, eventually that, you know, that market clogs up and dries up. So I think, you know, in the case of a film like Insomnia, I think that we're all very hopeful that there'll be an audience for... I mean, I wouldn't consider it a small film in the same way that Memento was somewhat small. It's certainly bigger in scope, but it's more focused on human emotions, human dilemmas, and I think the genre I'm working in, whilst there's an element of darkness and fear and paranoia involved in it, I think in a lot of ways it's very relevant, immediately relevant to a lot of the things, a lot of the fears and neurosis and everything that we all go through in everyday life. So I think that there is an audience for those kinds of stories because I think that they speak to us in a very direct manner.
I'm interested in what you think about the new directors coming up. Obviously, mm-hmm. you're someone who's new in Hollywood, but someone like Baz Luhrmann mm-hmm. and M. Night Shyamalan and, you know, there's a bunch of Spike Jonze would be another one. Mm-hmm. They seem to be reworking some of the vernacular or the vocabulary of film, and I'm just wondering what you see there.
Well, what I see there is an acceptance, perhaps, on the part of the powers that be that fresh voices in... certainly when you're looking at directors, writers as well, but fresh voices and a level of innovation is vital to Hollywood, you know, to keep feeding the machine in a sense, to keep things fresh, but not too fresh is probably the attitude. But I think what Baz Luhrmann was able to do with Moulin Rouge, I mean, it's an extraordinary achievement that he could get that through the studio system. And similarly, you know, you mentioned Spike Jonze and filmmakers like that, or I would look at Steven Soderbergh, who's also a producer on Insomnia, but he's been able to, with a film like Traffic, you know, he's been able to create that hybrid of the studio film with the individual voice still being heard and still influencing the feel of that material. And I think that's very encouraging for the future of studio films, definitely.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was reading your bio stuff, and you started off with an 8mm camera, making it when you were lots of films
super
in your
8.
Super 8. Sorry. And I think I'm looking at all these kids with DV cameras.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you see there. Do you see a new generation coming up following in your footsteps?
Well, I think absolutely there's an enormous opening up of home technologies. What I'll be interested to see is where the discipline of things goes, because I think I was very fortunate to be really the last generation of people who were able to experiment with film as a kid. I mean, I was 7 years old when I started making films. And so I learned a lot about economy and you know, you're using these 3-minute cartridges, you know, that it takes 2 weeks to get it back from, you know, Kodak and develop it and everything. So I had to put a lot of planning and a lot of thought into even the simple stuff that I was experimenting with my friends as a kid. And it'll be interesting to see the difference with kids now who have DV cams where you can record hours and hours and really experiment, see what you're doing, edit it instantly. So I think there'll probably be a shift over time in terms of the capture of images and how they're edited.
Christopher Nolan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was On Point movie maven Garen Daly speaking with Christopher Nolan, director of last year's sleeper hit Memento and the new film Insomnia, which opens May 24th. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.